Accession number 20474, Reel 2.
Peter Knox, Reel 2.
The next, or the first landfall we came to was the Azores, where we didn't land, but we took on water and some stores. I'm talking about the whole convoy. And our next landfall was Freetown, Sierra Leone, where again we weren't allowed to land, but we took on some supplies. And at that time, German U-boats were quite active in the Atlantic, but they didn't attack our convoy, fortunately. I should say at this stage that the convoy after the one I was on, the South Allen was sunk, torpedoed. After Freetown, we sailed down the west coast of Africa, and the next landfall was Cape Town for us. The convoy split into two. Half went to Durban and half went to Cape Town. And it was surprisingly cold at Cape Town. This would be, let's think, end of July, early August. It was the winter, of course, being southern hemisphere. And as luck would have it, I fell for job as duty officer the first night we were there. Everybody else went ashore, except the guard on the ship and duty officer, which is myself. I remember having to put on my greatcoat that night on duty on the ship. It was so cold. It's unbelievable. The next day, I was, of course, off duty. I had a lovely job of being in charge of the troops and the officers coming ashore, from ashore, on board by midnight, and in various states of inebriation. But there we go. After about 4 or 5 days there, which I spent ashore in Cape Town, had a very nice time. The South African people were extremely generous to us. We were taken out to dances in the evening and lunch and drinkies and God knows what. It was they really made a fuss of us, and they did this for every convoy that came through. It was marvellous, Cape Town, after a rather drab and dreary UK with a blackout and bombing. Cape Town with massive lights, no blackout there, masses of food, no rationing, of course. And the Europeans, of course, there were mostly of British and some of still of Dutch origin and other European origins, but had a very high standard of living by our standards. Well, after we left Cape Town, the other half of the convoy joined up with us from Durban, and we sailed across the Indian Ocean and arrived in Bombay in August. I can't tell you the date, but it was somewhere around about the middle of August, middle or second half of August, put it that way. And my colleague Michael Knowles and myself, we stayed at the Taj Mahal Hotel, which was very comfortable. And after one or two nights there, we took the train to join our regiment, which was stationed in Bihar. The cantonment was called Dinapur.
What had been your first impressions of India at that time?
Where? In Bombay?
Yes. And crossing India?
Well, it was all very new, and we were very young, remember. It made a great impression on us. We were both only 20. And he was more or less the same age as me, and I think he was about a week or two younger than me. We travelled overnight, so we couldn't see much during the night. But we sent a telegram from the Taj to the adjutant of the regiment to say, please arrange reception, arriving on the Calcutta mail at 0430 or 0500 hours, whatever it was, something earlier hours in the morning. Eventually we got to the Dinapur station, which is just outside Patna, the capital of Bihar. And we were met by a truck from the regiment, and an NCO, a couple of guys, loaded our baggage onto the truck, and we went off. And when we got there, we'd found that the other six of our officers, who was on our contingent, as it were, draft, had already arrived. They'd gone on a different ship, and they'd docked earlier than us, and at Bombay, and they got away earlier. So there were eight young officers, well, not some of them not so young, actually, some were late 20s, which was considered quite old in those days. We were accommodated in various places in the cantonment, and told to report to the officer commanding the station the next morning. We were initiated into the mess, which was very comfortable, right by the River Ganges, which runs nearby. Very picturesque, really. Very impressive. And it certainly impressed me, the warmth of the Indian morning. We had breakfast there, the bright lights, the sky, some sunshine. The monkeys playing in the mess garden. There was a detachment there, and the detachment commander was none other than my old friend Terry Malloy, who lives at Swanage, whom you've met. He'd just been promoted captain, and the rest of the battalion was up in the hills at a station called Rani Khet, where British units, regiments, used to go in the hot weather and come down into the plains in the once the hot weather abided. It was less severe. And of course we had married families as well, and they all had to come down with the regiment. And they turned up about 3 or 4 days later. And there were peacetime barracks there, very comfortable, really, by all standards. Pre-war peacetime barracks. And the men were pretty comfortable, had nice bedding. Each one had a mosquito net. They had Indian servants to clean their boots and do their blankoing and their laundry. They had a super life compared with soldiering in at home. We were posted to various companies, the eight of us. They were very short of subalterns. So two went to each company, if I remember rightly. And so we did our training there with our companies. And We were introduced to the commanding officer at the time, Lieutenant Colonel J.V. Bruin, M.C., and the other officers. And I was sent on a course to Pachmari, which is in central provinces. It was the army gas school in India. The gas training in India was a bit primitive. I didn't think gas would ever be used in war out in India or in the Far East.
In what way was it primitive?
They were issued with gas masks, or respirators, anti-gas, as the official army description. But they were most uncomfortable in a tropical climate. After the Abyssinian War, the Italians used during that conflict with the Abyssinians in 1936-37, they used mustard gas against the Abyssinians, who had no protection at all, and it was considered that mustard gas might be used by any enemy in India. Of course, at that time, the Japs were not our enemy, but we knew very well that if there was going to be any, if the balloon went up, it would be the Japs. And the Germans were a long way away. But then I went on this course, and I was made gas officer in the regiment. And I converted a building in the cantonment in the barracks area as a gas chamber, and everybody in the battalion had to go through the gas chamber. We used little pellets of tear gas, which were heated under like a Bunsen burner on a tray, and they gave off the gas, and everybody had to go in and experience what it was like wearing a respirator. And they had to put their fingers there, two fingers there on the side, and open it up so they got the whiff of it. And they came all out coughing and spluttering, and the CO and other officers thought it was a damn bad show that they had to go through this. I said, this is compulsory. Army instructions, GHQ, Delhi. So it wasn't exactly the flavour of the week. But then we had Christmas, more or less peacetime Christmas, 1941. In those days, after church parade, the men sat down to their Christmas dinner, and in good old-fashioned regimental war, pre-war conditions, the officers waited on the men. And by which time we were wearing blue patrols. It was quite chilly in the night time, so you could wear blues. You know, blue tunic and trousers and blue cap, black cap we actually wore. They're called blue patrols. And shortly after Christmas, I was sent on another course to Sorgha, which is in central India, to learn all about brain gun carriers. And whilst I'd been there for about a week or so, I was summoned to the office and told that you're under orders to proceed immediately to return to your regiment, as your regiment's been mobilized. Singapore had fallen by then. Hong Kong had fallen, Singapore had fallen, Malaya had fallen, and the Japs had invaded Burma. And we were mobilized in Dinapore. We were suddenly issued with modern equipment, which none of the peacetime officers or NCOs knew anything about, like a brain gun. We had to instruct, we who came out from UK only recently, had to instruct everybody in the use of a brain gun. Which is our main light machine gun. Well, eventually we set off by train to Calcutta and aborded an old ship called the Jalla Durga, which had been an Indian pilgrim ship which plied between India and the Red Sea. What's the name of the port there on the Red Sea? For Mecca. Mecca's inland, of course. But, we found ourselves brigaded with the 1st Devons and the 2nd Border Regiment. But no brigadier, no brigade staff. So the three COs of the three British battalions on board this ship got together and they appointed the senior CO as the brigade commander. And he appointed a chap who'd been through staff college as his brigade major, and somebody else as staff captain. And so there we were. And it was extremely crowded in the ship. You can imagine, three battalions. They weren't fully up to war strength, I should think. 500 to 600 men, I should think, at the most. Certainly no more than 600. The transport went on another ship. One of my friends at that time was MTO, and he had to get all his 1,500 weight trucks and 1,300 weight trucks onto this ship, so with the other two battalions. And we sailed off in convoy, all ready to sail to Rangoon. And our orders were to land at Rangoon and defend the airfield at Rangoon. And if necessary, thwart the advance of the Japanese. Well, just before we got to the end of the River Hooghly, which runs into the Bay of Bengal, we, in the middle of the night, we received a signal from Delhi: return at once to Calcutta. Rangoon has fallen. So the message didn't get through to us until later. But I was slept on deck with another pal of mine. Like a lot of other officers, managed to find a corner on deck to sleep. It was more comfortable than down below. And I said to him, I remember very well, I said, "Ted, we're going in the wrong direction. We've turned around. Instead of going south, we're going north. We're going back." And of course, the word got round very shortly afterwards that of the news that Rangoon had fallen, and we were to return to Calcutta. Before that, at least one regiment, if not two, had sailed from British regiments, had sailed from Calcutta. And they, as soon as they landed at Rangoon, they turned around and marched off back to India. They couldn't get out. They couldn't fly out. They couldn't sail out. The Rangoon, the city of Rangoon was under Japanese control, and in no movement of shipping, British shipping, could be acceptable to them. So they had to march back all that long way. I think it was the Cosbys, King's Own Scottish Borders, that went before us. One battalion. They only went a few days before, and they got a nasty reception. They got bombed heavily as they landed, disembarked. So we had orders to go back to where we came from. Dinapur. And only for a week or two, or maybe a month, no, I didn't think of it, we were there. We were sent to Secunderabad, where we joined up with other British units. And it was a big garrison town, Secunderabad. We were in Trimalgary barracks. And as a matter of interest, they, at that time, Wingate was there with his crowd. He had a brigade consisting of, I think, the 10th or 12th battalion of the King's Regiment, King's Liverpool, some Gurkhas and Indian troops. And they were training in the outside Secunderabad, but you could see them in Secunderabad. They used to come in on an evening for a leave. But after 2 months in Secunderabad, in which time the monsoon broke, I remember it well because it was about my birthday, May the 16th. And I was having a little party to celebrate my 21st birthday. And we were ordered to Ceylon to proceed there, where we joined up with the Devons and the Border. I think I made a mistake about the Jaladoga. The other British battalion was not there. It was the Welsh regiment. That's right, the Welsh and the second Border. Yes. When we got to Ceylon, the Welsh were kept behind, and we joined up with the Devons. They joined us in Ceylon with us, and we were brigaded and turned into the 20th Indian Division, with a proper divisional commander, staff, and everything. And there were three brigades, and our brigade was the 32nd Brigade, consisting of the 1st Northamptons, 3rd 8th Gurkhas, and 4th 10th Gurkhas. And it was just considered by Army Command that it was better to introduce an Indian battalion into each brigade and not have two Gurkha battalions and one British battalion. So we lost the 3rd, 8th Gurkhas. And we got the 9th, 14th Punjabis in their place. I should say that the first week we spent in Ceylon was in a wretched rubber plantation. I say wretched. It was hot and sticky. It rained every evening. You could set your watch by it at about 5 or 6 o'clock. Everything turned to rust. We had to have 2 rifle inspections a day. All leather goods had a mould on them if you left them a day. It was beastly. And it's quite different conditions from what we'd had in India. And but that first week was uncomfortable because we had to share our camp with an Australian battalion. And if you'll read one of my articles, you'll see that I've explained that this Australian brigade had been brought home as a result of the Japanese invasion of the Dutch East Indies and threat to Australia from Libya. The Australian Prime Minister insisted that the troops be brought home to defend their motherland in the Middle East. Well, with the threat to Ceylon after the fall of Burma, or Rangoon, basically, Churchill prevailed upon the Australian Prime Minister to let the Australian Brigade be diverted to Colombo and guard the coast, more or less the southeast part of the coast, east coast, and the naval base of Trincomalee. So there we were, an Australian battalion and a British battalion sharing the same accommodation. You can imagine it was pretty chaotic. The Australians are no respecter of tradition, regimental tradition. And they spent all their nights gambling, they could. A great gamble, as you know, the Australians, to gamble on anything. And, well, after a week, the Australians left, and we took over their positions on the coast and that country.
How did their lack of respect for tradition show itself?
Well, one night we're having a bit of a party in the officers' mess, and some of the Australian troops who were nearby got a bit fed up with our carousing and noise, and one Australian soldier came in, about 6 foot two tall, wearing a skimpy pair of shorts, and said, "Why don't you barons keep quiet? We're trying to get some sleep." And one of the Australian officers went out to him, punched him on the nose, knocked him down.
One of the Australians?
Yeah, yes. And this Australian soldier had no compunction of marching into the mess. The mess, I might tell you, was a grass hut. It was a big, you know, what they call a basher. A basher. And so that was that. So we took over the Australian positions. They left and went home to Australia.
And the name of this place in Ceylon?
In Ceylon, where we first stayed, Horana. Can I be relieved of this? Right. Shortly after the Australians as I left, having been on a Bren Gullin carrier course, I was posted there to our carrier platoon, the second in command to an old chum of mine called Tommy Goodman, who shortly afterwards, he himself was promoted or translated to brigade headquarters as brigade transport officer. So I got command of the carrier platoon. And we trained for some time in Ceylon with our Bren Gullin carriers, which is all very pleasant. We didn't do much marching, being mobile. And I had a very good crowd of chaps. And we enjoyed ourselves. We went all around the island and did a lot of firing out to sea with our Bren guns and so forth. And it was quite enjoyable, really. Particularly on the coast. Talk about serendipity. Ceylon was known as Serendip. The beaches were great. You had to be careful of the surf and then the undertow. And we finished that part of our training when we had to go down to a place called Hambantota, which is in the southeast corner of the island. We didn't take our carriers with us. They were left in harbour at our previous station at Horana. And we were told to get ready for jungle warfare. Because we were obviously under orders to go to Burma. And by which time, we'd formed a guerrilla platoon. And I had been on another course, guerrilla warfare at Sorga. And so I was put in command of the guerrilla platoon, because no carriers are left behind. And I'd learnt at the guerrilla warfare school at Sorga the use of explosives. And our job was to play around with explosives and blow things up, railway lines or bridges, and so forth and so on. And the day came when we had a big exercise in the island of Ceylon. All units and various parts of the HM forces, military and civil, were mobilized for this big exercise.